All right, everybody. This is Nima Yamini, and I'm here with a very special guest, a journalist here in Washington, D.C., a very intelligent young man. His name's Corey Walker. Welcome to the podcast, Corey.
Hey, thank you so much. Thank you for having me and inviting me. This is the first podcast I've been invited to talk specifically about Israel. And so, I think that this is something I'm looking forward to. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, man. I want to go over some of the things you said on X at your account at Corey Writing, because you've said some, pretty incredible things. I think the way you're able to understand and comprehend what's happening in Israel is just on point. You said something along the lines of the world coddles the Palestinian population and treats them like children without agency, lying to them by saying they're enduring genocide and apartheid, etc. Makes them believe the world is coming to save them rather than forcing them to negotiate with Israel like adults. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, so basically my beliefs are that the world tends to take everything up to level 100 when it comes to Israel, right? So like, it can never be, oh, Israel's just doing a war, or that, in the West Bank there are territorial disputes. It's just always the most extreme kind of interpretation of Israeli action. So it has to be a genocide, it has to be apartheid, it has to be ethnic cleansing. When in reality, if you look at the history of Israel-Palestine, obviously it's a tragedy, and there's been blood spilled on both sides. And I'm not saying that the Palestinians don't have any legitimate right to have a grievance. But with that said, the reality of what this conflict is, it's a territorial dispute. There's obviously religion involved, and the history is complex. For me, when I look at it from a geopolitical perspective, I think that the neighboring Arab countries have largely swindled the Palestinians by telling them, on one hand, we're with you, defeat the Zionist entity on one hand, but on the other hand, it's like, well, they don't do anything for them. Like, Palestinians have been expelled from neighboring Middle Eastern countries. Palestinians are not allowed to even evacuate Gaza because they can't go into Egypt, right? They've been trying to, since the beginning of the war, trying to allow for Palestinians to go into the Sinai. So when you talk about things like, for example, the high death count in Gaza, which is a tragedy, quite frankly, it could be higher. But one of the reasons why it is this way is that Palestinians are now allowed to evacuate. So the thing is that this is a very long-winded way of saying is that the only way Palestinians are going to get out of this is through acting like adults, taking agency, and coming to the table and negotiating with Israel. If you do believe that you're living in a version of apartheid South Africa or some other, some other genocide or whatever, then that's what you truly believe, then it kind of implies that some other third party is going to come save you, right? Whether it's the UN or Europe or some other entity is going to stand up against Israel. And that's not happening, at least not anytime soon. So instead of actually negotiating their way out of this like adults, what they've been doing is just endless armed resistance, which is futile because they don't have the military might anywhere close to what Israel has, thank God. So basically, they're in a position where they've doomed young Palestinian children and future generations of Palestinian children to live in misery because they keep fighting this, endless fight that they're not going to win. And also, I would argue it's just unjustified fight. So they believe that they're in this situation that, one, doesn't exist because there is no genocide and there isn't an apartheid state. But the fact that they keep being told this just encourages them to do these counterproductive actions, I'm misspeaking, that only harm themselves. And so that's basically where that tweet came from, or post. I know it's not Twitter anymore, it's X, sorry.
No, that's all right, man. You also said that far too many comparisons are being made right now between Israel, Palestine, and South Africa. Mm-hmm. In reality, Israel, Palestine is probably more similar to India, Pakistan. Mm-hmm. How so?
Well, South Africa was like a racialized apartheid state in which, for example, if you are black, even from another part of the world, right, like not even South Africa, you can travel to South Africa and have equal rights. Like, for example, I'm black. If I were to travel to South Africa in the year 1985, I would not be able to go on the all-white beaches in South Africa, right, or to ride the bus alongside white people or go to their restaurants. It was a racialized apartheid regime. And in that case, it was a system in which the white South Africans needed the labor of the black South Africans in order to continue to run that regime. They had to live in the fancy stands. And it was like a, you know, it was an exploitative regime. It was also an incredibly violent regime, much more violent, I think, than what you see in Israel, even though there's comparisons made between the two. And I think it was a system in which I think the system is fundamentally different, that Israel's not a racialized regime, right? So in Israel, you have obviously extremely diverse population. You have Ashkenazim, you have Mizrahim, you have Jews from Ethiopia, you have the Druze, you have Christians that even come from the United States that live in Israel. We have 20% of the population is Arab Israeli, which, you know, Palestinian descent. So it's definitely not a racialized regime. It's a very diverse country. And I also think that the comparison, if you think Israel-Palestine is a modern-day South Africa, do you think the solution for South Africa, in which it was, I guess, creating the so-called Rainbow Nation and ending apartheid, is the right solution? Now, in South Africa, the thing was that the younger white South Africans became more liberal than their parents, yeah, right? In Israel, it's actually the opposite. So younger Israelis are moving to the right, which yeah, kind of bucks a global trend. Like, younger Israelis are becoming more conservative. I also think probably post October 7th, that's even more so, even yes, probably moving further to the right on issues of security. So I think that you have a situation where Israel's moving to the far right. The political left in Israel is irrelevant and going to become even more relevant because those people are aging out and the younger generation is moving up, obviously, and they're more conservative. And then you have on the Palestinian side, they also are radicalizing even more. The global, you know, Islamic world, that world is radicalizing more. We're seeing a rise in Islamic radicalism even more so than before. And I think that the idea that you are going to, for example, create a one-state solution, which a lot of American progressives want, a one-state solution where everyone has equal right, equal votes, whatever. If this were a Disney film, then that probably would be the ending. But the reality is that I think that's more likely to end up like Yugoslavia, where you have all these different ethnic, racial, well, I shouldn't say racial, but like ethnic and cultural and religious groups who have these irreconcilable differences, and it just breaks into civil war. Because Israel-Palestine is not a race issue. They keep trying to portray it that way. It's not. It's nationalism in the sense of, like, these are two people who want different, they want a nation. Each side wants their own nation.
Yeah.
There's different ideas of what that nation should look like or how big it should be or whatever, what the border should be, but both sides want their own nation. And so the idea that you are going to throw all that at the wayside, which is the main mission of both Israelis and Palestinians, is nationalism and self-determination, that would probably take generations and an entire ideological shift that we're not there yet. But at the same time, to try to force this on people when they did not ask for this. The Palestinians aren't even asking for it. If you look at the polling, Palestinians never say that, oh, they want to live in a state side by side with the Israelis. They don't want that. They want their own nation. Same with the Israelis. So yeah, I think it's more like India-Pakistan, where you have to have a partition where both of these sides have you know, their national borders or whatever recognized, and that they each have their own right to self-determination. What that looks like when we get there, how long it's going to take, I have no idea. But the idea that it's just basically South Africa, I feel like the people who make that comparison are doing it because they have a very narrow view of history. Yeah. That's why I keep comparing Israel to either South Africa or Jim Crow United States, or they're even trying to compare Jews to Nazis right now. It's like, yeah, they know like five events in world history, which is why they keep referring to those five events, but they can't look at other like parallels which map much more neatly onto Israel-Palestine, in my view.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, sorry, I'm rambling.
No, man, I think you really nailed it. It's like they just don't have greater context. I mean, I'm a Jewish guy.
Yeah.
My family's from, you know, I was telling you, Jerusalem and Iran.
Okay.
And I married, my wife is German.
Okay.
And on her grandmother's birth certificate, there's a Nazi logo. Mm. In fact, that was the first American on her family land in Northwest Germany, Deutschland, Bochum.
Okay.
Since her grandmother had American troops there, like giving them candy, that they had a lot. They were Black Americans, because the Black Americans in that region of Germany would go, and give gifts and sweets and stuff to the local kids. Mm-hmm. So I'm literally the first American in it was 70 years on that land. Anyway, I say something to say, in Germany, we don't joke about the Nazi stuff. They don't trivialize it nearly as much as they do here in the United States, man. It's so vulgar and offensive to the fact of, I think you just nailed it when you just say it's a lack of context. Yeah, they don't have enough depth of world history to understand. Hey, that's a good point. Is it more similar to Pakistan, India? Why are we saying this is Nazi genocide? Meanwhile, the Palestinian population has done nothing but build and scale. I mean, how is this a genocide in the last 50 years, when the Palestinian population is actually maybe building faster than the Israeli population? I mean, this is ridiculous. So as an African American, I'd like to see what you think here. You say comparing Palestinians to American Blacks is so historically illiterate. Black people never had a chance to negotiate for our freedom. Palestinian political movements have no interest in living peacefully alongside Jews. These are very different situations. If you could please explain here.
Well, I think in the history of the United States, Black people were immiserated, oppressed, enslaved, made into second class citizens for 350 plus years. And from 1619 all the way to the 1960s, the United States. So a very long time. Now, in that time frame, we never had, an opportunity to, negotiate our way out of that. So if you want to say Israel is being oppressive to the Palestinians, I can listen to that argument. I don't agree with it, but I can listen to it. But I think that the comparisons are just flat out wrong. Like, for example, like I said, America was a racialized, segregation regime. In the case of Israel-Palestine, it's not the case. So, for example, like I've said before, 20% of the Israeli population itself is Arab-Israeli. They're integrated into the population. They really, they serve in the military by and large. They identify as Israeli more so than Palestinian or Arab. So there's a lot more efforts I think Israel does to integrate their own ethnic minorities into their country as opposed to America did for Black Americans, which is complete segregation on the basis of race. And so much so that even partial Black Americans, if you're biracial, my grandfather's biracial, he was considered 100% Black for legal purposes. So he was subjected to the, most brutal racial regimes from Mississippi. So that is so different than, I think, in even the West Bank, where, there are the settlements and all that. That's so controversial. Even within Israel, people, there's protests, there's people for and against it, and it's deeply controversial. It's deeply controversial in our government. But I think that there's a huge difference in the sense of these are contested territories, right? So these are not territories in which, everyone technically is supposed to, by law, have equal rights or anything like that. Israel is at war with the Palestinians. So there's not, I can't think of really many examples or any examples in which people who've gone to war with the population grant 100% equal rights to that population that they are at war with, right? So that is a major difference between what's happening in America, historically America, versus what's happening in Israel. But beyond that, like I said, you can negotiate the Palestinians, those negotiations have collapsed. And there's an unwillingness to accept the reality that they're not going to get, all of the land back that they had, 19-whenever, prior to the existence of the State of Israel. With that said, I also would say that the checkpoints the things that, for example, Ta-Nehisi Coates brought up in his book, The Wall, that wasn't necessarily always there. And it's important to acknowledge that that stuff got erected because of legitimate security concerns that Israel did have. And the Second Intifada brought about a lot of this. I mean, I would say that in America, for example, a better comparison in America would be after 9/11. No, after 9/11, prior to 9/11, remember, you could literally walk from, if you drop someone off at the airport, you can literally walk them to their gate and hang out with them for maybe an hour or two until their plane got, and they would get on their, plane, and there was very minimal security at the airport. Now you can't do that. Now you have to walk through like multiple checkpoints, you gotta show your ID. It's like, it can take a long process. It can take literally hours to do it. And that is, I think, a better comparison to what you see in the West Bank, where yeah, you have to like walk through checkpoints and there's a wall, and all that stuff is deeply unfortunate, but it's a consequence of actual political decisions that the Palestinians made. And those decisions to do things like suicide bombings. So I think that that is a better comparison, thinking about America's security state post 9/11. I think that obviously, you know, you can make an argument for what caused this or why they did it or whatever, but the reality is that they did it, and actions come with consequences. The better path forward, I think, is to figure out how to negotiate and how to end this. Because obviously you want to get to a future where there are no checkpoints, things like that. But there has to be a good faith effort on both sides to try to make that happen.
You know, it's interesting today when, you know, the big news that the Hamas leader was assassinated, right? And I remember just a few days back, the leader of Spain, France, Ireland, and Italy, they were, you know, the way they spoke about the UN peacekeepers that were being harmed against the Israelis, and it just seemed like it was as if no one was really maybe taking the word that maybe terrorists were hiding and using the United Nations. And now I think the leader, Antonio, you know, the head of the UN, I think that he's largely destroyed so much of the credibility of the United Nations. And if we lose the United Nations, I think all the world loses the benefit of having an impartial organization. Now I want to ask you about something here. Are you familiar with this person, Mahar Attar?
I am personally not, no.
Okay, so he basically worked in the Obama and Biden administration. And right now, he's doing work. He worked at the National Security Council, as you can see here. In 2017, he joined the House Intelligence Committee as general counsel for the Democrats. And now, you can see what he's doing. In January 2024 of this year, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan moved Batar into a new role at the NSC, National Security Council, as Deputy Assistant to the President and Coordinator for Intelligence and Defense Policy. Batar is the highest ranking official at the White House responsible for coordinating the U.S. government's intelligence and defense policy. Now this guy, the story doesn't end here. This guy, guess where he worked?
Where?
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency.
UNRWA.
In Jerusalem.
Okay.
And guess who the bodyguard of the Hamas leader worked as a teacher?
UNRWA, probably?
UNRWA. Yeah. The same organization, and he has it on his identification. Mm-hmm. This person, you could say, has been seen in an image with like a terrorist organization, essentially. Now, one could say, is he a Pakistani first or an American first? Is he giving information to terrorist organizations in the Middle East? And also, one more thing. Is he one reason why now Israel is maybe not giving information and intelligence to the White House? Is this the sort of staffing that we could expect could come if the Democrats win the White House?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if I can go too deep into that individual person, as I haven't. I'm just reading the summary. But I think that it kind of hits at a larger theme, in that a lot of the people who tend to work in foreign policy in the United States and tend to care about Israel-Palestine are actually anti-Israel. right? So a lot of the people who work in, for example, the State Department, I mean, there were so many like resignations that we saw, people coming out, like writing entire op-eds, letters, slamming the Biden administration for giving weapons to Israel. And this was like November of last year. So like maybe a month or less than a month into Israel's military response after October 7th. So these are people saying like, oh, how dare, we shouldn't be giving Israel weapons, blah, blah, blah. And this is a staffing problem we have right now, of which people who work in these agencies are feel emboldened to speak out against American foreign policy, our decisions, are openly condemning, you know, America for siding with its allies. And I think that, yeah, it's a very huge concern. And that's something that I said about, you know, the upcoming election. And I'm a journalist, so I shouldn't probably take a side. But I will say, just my observations, is that one fascinating thing is that a lot of progressives have already said that they are kind of aligning themselves and arranging themselves right now, getting themselves together. So to, if Kamala Harris wins, they want to stuff basically the foreign policy divisions of her administration. So they are kind of already making a list of who they want to put in, right? So Kamala Harris may go on stage and say, I'm with Israel. She literally said to DNC, we'll have the most lethal military force. We'll always stand with Israel, yada, yada, yada. She may believe that. Maybe she does, I don't know. I actually would say that she waffles on Israel quite a bit. But even if she did believe it, giving her the benefit of the doubt, a lot of the people that are younger liberals hate Israel. And so these are people who, if they are within the, you know, upcoming administration, the Harris administration, if she were to win, if she wins in November, I think that they are going to do everything they can to try to drive a wedge between the American-Israel relationship, try to end Israel's military campaign in Gaza, probably be more likely to, you know, push America, at least the Democratic Party, further away from Israel. So I don't know how far that is, but things like, for example, being more equivocating and more in the center, and not necessarily standing with Israel versus Hamas, but just like taking a neutral stance, or condemning Israel more. I mean, we've already seen this with young liberals, how, for example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, not only does she wrongly call the war in Gaza a genocide, but she's also, you know, condemned the pager attack in Lebanon. And so it's like, you know, what do you want? It's like, you're condemning the bombing in Gaza, which admittedly is sad, it did kill many civilians, but then you also condemn the pager attack in Lebanon. So you have to explain to me what military operations can these young liberals approve of when it comes to Israel. And I don't think that there's many, which is why I think that, and it's not really a Kamala Harris problem per se, I think it's just more of an ideological and generational drift that we see with Democrats away from Israel. And even if the president, even if Kamala Harris herself, you know, is an ally of Israel, we cannot, I would actually argue, it probably is probable that the next foreign policy, administration or next foreign policy, you know, installations in government, those bureaucrats, they will be much more critical of Israel and will be lobbying to, you know, do like arms embargoes and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's smart that Israel is essentially, I would say, I'd like to think that they're planning for a day when the United States is no longer there to support as much. Now, that could also happen because the American economy could collapse. There could be a world war. I mean, there's no guarantee that America will always be the number one superpower and a standalone superpower. So I think either way, it's important that Israel is a standalone and able to defend itself, right? That being said, you've said before that Zionism is arguably the most successful liberation movement to ever exist. Jews have created a blueprint for all historically oppressed groups to follow. Instead of wallowing in endless grievance, I think Black Americans need our own Zionism. It's better than requesting more DEI. Now, before I ask you to elaborate on that, man, I think you nailed it. I think you nailed it, man. Please.
Thank you for the compliment. Yeah, that was me, I think, being cheeky. I think that there's a lot to unpack there. Yeah. So I think Zionism is a liberation movement, right? Jews are historically oppressed groups throughout Europe, throughout the Middle East, Africa. And so what, you know, Jews did with Zionism, they said, okay, we can't rely on the world to protect us. We saw that with the Holocaust and also, you know, the very many pogroms and indignities that Jews have to deal with in the Middle East. So they said, we're going to have our own nation, we have to have our own military. We have to have our own society to defend our interests. And so Zionism was liberation from that oppression, but liberation not by demanding your oppressors give you handouts. It was more about liberation via building something of your own. And Israel, which is a successful nation, exists to defend the interests of the Jewish people, defend their safety, defend their material interests, and, you know, defend their future. Because they know that they cannot rely on the world to protect them. And we've seen this after October 7th, the celebrations in the street. People saying, you know, just the most anti-Semitic things about, you know, Jews need to burn in hell, die, whatever, Jews are controlling the world, all this other stuff. I think that all of that reinforced why it's important for Israel to exist and the importance of Zionism. Regardless of what historical flaws it may have, no movement is perfect. The founding of the United States wasn't perfect. But regardless, we can still say that it is an unambiguous good that the United States has founded, and I can also say unambiguously it's good that Israel has founded. Now, moving into the other part of that, which I talked about Black Americans, that was more like a personal thing in which I was saying that, well, when I look at Black history in our current, the current political landscape, because I follow, obviously I talk about Israel-Palestine, but I also am Black, so I follow Black American stuff too, is that so much of Black America is about, right now our political kind of machine is oriented towards basically requesting more handouts from white people and trying to say, well, white people, you did all these horrible things, slavery, Jim Crow, so give me more handouts, give me more preferences, give me affirmative action, give me reparations, give me this, give me that. My thing about that is that it's not liberation, because what you're literally demanding stuff from other people who did that. Well, they didn't, the white people around the day, they knew the oppression, but hypothetically, just to say what white people did the oppression, just in the general sense, right, historically. But you're demanding the system that oppressed you to give you more stuff. The problem with that is that, one, politically, it's probably not going to happen, right? We don't have the votes in the Senate to get reparations or whatever. And it's extremely unpopular. But second is that if you go out around and you're demanding things from people through the government, that stuff can be taken away, right? All that can be taken away. We're kind of right now interesting in this country in an anti like DEI mode in which a lot of these DEI programs are being challenged by the courts and they're being repealed, struck down, whatever. Because we have more conservative courts now, federally. And the thing is that if you are constantly at the whims of the government, you know, and you're demanding things from the government, live by the government, die by the government. Now, comparing that to Zionism, why I said Zionism, it was like, okay, Jews who live in Israel are not necessarily at the whims of Europe. Right? Europe can be as anti-Semitic as it wants to be. That doesn't, and not to say it doesn't have any impact on Jews in Israel, because things like the UN and unfortunately we live in an interconnected world. But by and large, Jews who live in Europe are kind of like insulated from that. Sorry, Jews who live in Israel are largely insulated from that to a degree. In fact, like you saw a lot of like upticks in Aliyah to Israel from Europe and even Canada. Because you see the rampant anti-Semitism there, and people are like, oh, we need to have here when we go to a place where we're safe, which is Israel. And I think Black Americans need to do a similar thing. Not necessarily that we need to have our own state, but I think that we need to have institutions that serve our interests in the sense of, like, it's about building up the Black community in a positive manner, not trying to extract things from white people or make white people feel guilty, but we're trying to do things to improve ourselves so future generations of Black people don't have to deal with the struggles that Black people are currently dealing with, which is a very long list of issues.
Yeah, because You said something along the lines of Black Americans should look to Israel as inspiration.
Yeah.
Israel represents a rejection of victimhood politics, as you were saying, and an acceptance of self-determination and responsibility, as you're saying, your own institutions. It represents what historically oppressed people could accomplish, can accomplish through ingenuity and grit. That's very nice of you, man. So I want to talk about Trevor Noah. Trevor Noah is like really like this. I mean, I feel like he became famous largely making jokes that essentially didn't offend anybody.
Right.
Like he played it extremely safe. I guess it's like so once the guy gets put on, once he gets on, he gets, you know, he does have some success. Anyway, then you see him with Tekashi Coates. Tinashe Coates. Tinashe Coates. And you say that Trevor Noah says he's angry at Tony DeCoupole for mispronouncing his names. I apologize. For asking Coates, it just gives you an idea how much MSM I watch. But I try to watch it. I do try to watch. I do try to see it just so I can see the.
No one watches those shows.
You know. Yeah.
So, like 80,
yeah. I mean, I don't feel like that guy should have got beat up the way he did.
No,
honestly.
Of course,
I mean,
not.
It was ridiculous. For asking Coates simple questions about Israel.
Yeah.
Then he compares Hamas's October 7th slaughter to the American Revolution. We are seeing the normalization of pro-Hamas sentiment and pro-terrorism ideology in elite liberal spaces. If you elaborate a little bit here.
Yeah, so there's a lot there. I may have to like actually remind me of like each individual. But to touch on it, I said that when it comes to Trevor Noah, he's kind of representative of just like this sort of elite liberal malaise when it comes to just like anti-Semitism and also just the burgeoning pro-terrorism sentiment, where he just like sat there, nodded along, did not challenge Ta-Nehisi Coates. Didn't ask him to elaborate, didn't ask why did you not go into the historical, reasons of why they are, why the West Bank has this, set up the way it is. He just sat there. And I think that that's troubling because it kind of is almost like accepting of this kind of pro-Hamas sentiment in which, and actually pro-Iran sentiment in which you paint Israel in the worst possible light possible with no actual elaboration, and we're just all supposed to sit there and take it. And that's like a pro-Hamas, pro-Iran. So that's what they want us to do. I thought it was like really lazy of them to sit there and talk about it that way. And I also think that we see this kind of like sentiment in within our institutions that you're not allowed to have really any position that's even considered somewhat right-wing. And I think we're getting to the point where like support of Israel is perceived as like a conservative thing rather than just like a universal bipartisan thing. And so to be a progressive, you kind of have to be like anti-Israel. And so that's why you see when Ta-Nehisi Coates did his media circuit tour, everywhere except CNBC, they just like sat there, nodded along, didn't say anything. And they just accepted what he said at face value without asking him, without challenging him in any way. I think that we live in a society where ideological diversity is not accepted or not tolerated. Now, we really want racial diversity. We want gender diversity. We want all kinds of diversity, except diversity in the way people think and diversity of opinion. And when Tony DeCoupole, I think that's his name, I'm probably butchering it too, but in his case, like he is Jewish, he has family that lives in Israel, so he challenged Coates, and rightfully so, and he was condemned for that by people behind the scenes, the staffers, who apparently were like crying. Like, how are you a grown adult and you're crying at a journalist for asking literal journalistic questions? But they were crying, apparently, and were demanding that CBS brass basically punish him for doing his job, which is to ask questions. I thought it was absurd. It's reflective of a broader issue in our society where like adults don't want to be adults, they want to act like they're children. But that's a whole nother aside. This is something that, like I said, it's an issue. Like they just want anti-Israel sentiment to just be nodded along with and accepted without being challenged. In the case of Tony DeCoupole, he was brave enough just to like ask some basic questions, and he was condemned by the so-called race and like sensitivity, race and culture, DEI department. Overdoing that, And I just think that that's, you know, messed up. Like, I think that he did what he was supposed to do. And I think that it shouldn't, like, I don't think we should live in a society in which ideological diversity, whether it's, even if it's critical of Israel, I think it should be allowed on television. But I also think that, you know, there needs to be, like, more context in the way that we discuss these things. I was disappointed in the way that CBS behind the scenes handled that. But like I said, that type of behind the scenes fury is reflected in basically all of our early institutions. You see it on college campuses right now. And so they're afraid to speak up and say the right things and condemn Hamas and, you know, and support Israel, largely because they don't want to be eaten alive by their left-wing young 20-something staffers. And that's basically what this—that's what this comes down to. You see it everywhere. Like, you see it, like I said, on college campuses. Pod Save America, which is like a very like liberal, popular pod, they actually are having a behind-the-scenes meltdown because the hosts, which are like Obama boys, they were all in the Obama administration, they won't go far enough to basically be pro-Palestine. And so the people behind the scenes are like wearing keffiyehs, not on camera, and they're trying to demand that y'all get on board. So like it's a huge pressure push within our elite institutions, and that is why I made that comment, because I'm pretty sure Trevor Noah, he didn't want to be eaten alive, so he didn't say anything, right? So like, you know, that's why I felt compelled to speak on that.
So when it comes to Nasi Coates, you say that he's trying to normalize sympathizing with Hamas. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, he talked about how October 7th, and he says that essentially that he wouldn't be above taking part in October 7th style attack, which is, you know, you got free speech, man. You just like, that's a good example of, hey, man, you got free speech to say what you want. I found that offensive.
Right, of course.
You know, all right. So he says, so you say that he's trying to normalize sympathizing with Hamas. These comments are ignorant, a historical and anti-Semitic. He's a charlatan, an overrated public thinker. Imagine someone publicly supporting the Taliban or ISIS. This is revolting. If you could please go a little bit. Yeah, you know?
I feel like I'm way more aggressive on social media than I am in real life. Yeah. I think that's most people. Like, I'm much more polemic on social media than I am in my actual life. I said that. Listen, he didn't go into Gaza, right, on his 10-day trip. He took a 10-day trip to Israel, in which he spent 5 days in Israel and apparently 5 days in the West Bank. Did not read any actual supplemental history, but he does talk about history in the message, apparently, but the history is largely messed up and wrong. He only talked to pro-Palestinian, you know, people. He only talked to Palestinians and also Jews who hate Israel, right? So, like, that was his entire lens through which he saw the conflict, and then said that he doesn't want to have to address the pro-Israel side, so he wants to get the quote-unquote, I think, bullshit out of the picture or something like that. So basically doesn't want to even look at things from an Israeli perspective. And I say all that, that's an aside, to say that when you have that perspective, it doesn't surprise me that you are pro-October 7th, right? In which he will say that, yeah, October 7th was really, really bad, but, you know, I can see myself doing it. It's like, no, like, it's, I can imagine me saying, well, you know, I can see myself flying a plane into, like, the World Trade Center. Like, I could see that. You know, could you imagine, like, any other, like, horrific terrorist attack or any event, whether it's 9/11 or whether it's, you know, the Sandy Hook shooting or anything like that, saying, like, I could see myself doing something that terrible of these circumstances. And the ahistorical part, I said, was because he is someone who, like I said, he doesn't understand the history, so he doesn't understand that Hamas as an entity is not, they didn't do October 7th because they wanted to liberate Palestine or whatever nonsense leftist progressives said. They did October 7th because Iran, which is Hamas's funder and backer, is the one who told them to do that. And they did it because they wanted to draw Israel into a war within Gaza and spark a broader regional war within the Middle East with the goal of ending, basically, or toppling Israel's normalization process with Saudi Arabia and basically eliminating the Abraham Accords, right? That was the goal. It was geopolitics. It was not this simplistic, you know, romanticized, oh, the oppressed people are rising up against the oppressors. And it's ahistorical partially because it implies that Hamas cares about Palestinians. Hamas does not care about Palestinians. When aid goes into Gaza, Hamas is the first one to literally intercept the aid trucks and keep the aid away from the Palestinians. And I'm talking about not just one or two aid trucks. I'm about like 80% of the aid trucks that go into Gaza are literally intercepted. And it's not Israel that says this. These are international organizations saying this. Even international organizations who don't like Israel are saying that Hamas is intercepting these aid trucks. They take that aid, they resell it to the population at a tax price. All of their leaders don't live within Gaza. They live in Qatar, and they're filthy rich. When they do their interviews with CNN or whatever, they're doing it for some luxury Qatari penthouse. They're not living in poverty and misery with the Palestinian people in Gaza. They have all enriched themselves off of, like, basically embezzlement and international fraud fundraisers and charities that are rooted in the United States and Europe. Hamas literally slaughters other Palestinians who speak out against their rule. There is no freedom of speech within Gaza. So this idea that Hamas actually cares about Palestinians when they are stealing their food, when they intentionally starve them, when they enrich themselves off of their plight, Hamas, we all know that they use human shields, but they will even, by gunpoint, force Palestinians who stay within areas where they know Israel is going to retaliate with a missile attack, right? And this isn't Israel saying this. This is not, quote unquote, Hasbara. This is Palestinian in Gaza saying Hamas is forcing our people to stay in these areas where they know we're going to die. Yahya Sinwar text messages were acquired by the Wall Street Journal. In those text messages, he literally was saying he wants there to be more martyrs. He wants there to be more deaths within Gaza because he knows that that helps their long-term goal of making Israel look worse. He does not care about Palestinian people. He views them as like just disposable pawns in his greater quest to destroy the Jewish state. So that's why it kind of pissed me off what Ta-Nehisi Coates said, because if you don't know all this about Hamas, you don't know their thought process, and it's so ignorant and it's dangerous because he has a lot of influence, right? Like, he's not just some obscure writer somewhere writing dumb stuff on the internet that no one sees. He is literally a liberal darling. His books are bestsellers. He can influence an entire generation of people and their thought process in Israel. And when you're looking at Hamas from a sympathetic standpoint, a standpoint of where you're trying to project your own personal emotions and American history and also onto them, and this is literally a jihadist terrorist group, that is extremely dangerous. And so, yeah, it should be repudiated. But unfortunately, we're not going to do that because, you know, we live in a society of cowards.
Yeah, you say something along the lines of anti-Israel. You say in a tweet, anti-Israel hatred shows that minorities are only liked if they are weak. Jews are experiencing a spike in anti-Semitism, partially because they have actually succeeded in building a prosperous, independent country. The social justice crowd only sympathizes with the world's losers. And you know, it's interesting you say that, man, because I remember when Elon Musk did this, like, meme, mm-hmm. where it was like, the idea was like, just because you're the wealthier, you know, more powerful country does not mean that you're wrong morally.
Yeah.
Versus the country that might be poor.
Yeah.
But listen, man, Corey, this was this was fantastic, man. You know, this is you have a very bright future ahead of you.
Thank you.
Where could everyone that's listening to the podcast, how could they find you? How could they talk to you? How could they, if they want to learn more from you and your ideas?
Yeah, so I mean, you can follow me on X, Twitter. My handle is Corey Writing, so C-O-R-E-Y-W-R-I-T-I-N-G.
I am a reporter. I write for Alga Minor, in which I do news reporting based on Israel and the broader Middle East, so Iran, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, stuff like that, and also domestic issues and how that impacts Israel and, you know, stuff like that. So, yeah, that's basically where you can find me if you're interested in learning more about the things that I write about.
All right, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Please subscribe to the podcast page, and thank you. Got it. All right, got here. Just this is just a backup. Yeah, man. 'Cause you know what, bro.